Welcome to Meet the People of MCB with Beverly Cascaden and Chip Haley, sponsored by the Missouri Council of the Blind. Let's get to it with this week's interview. Hello and welcome everyone to another edition of Meet the People of MCB. I'm Chip Haley.
And I'm Linda Gerken.
Hello, Linda. How you doing?
I am doing great. Other than it being really hot, it is a beautiful day today.
Oh, it is. But it is stifling out there. I don't know how warm it is where you're at. The last time I checked today, it was like 97 degrees.
Yes, and I think we are a little warmer than you, so it's warm, yes. But it's great. We're in the house where it's air conditioning.
Oh, that is true.
You and I are going to chit-chat and enjoy another visit with our guests, so it's a beautiful day.
Oh, it is indeed. And I tell you, Linda, I can't tell you how much I have been looking forward to today's interview. I am excited about it.
I am too. I enjoy listening to her.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to bring on at this time the president of the American Council of the Blind, Deb Cook-Lewis. Welcome, Deb, to Meet the People of MCB.
Well, thank you so much, Chip and Linda. It's great to be here with you this afternoon. And it's hot here, but I don't think it's as hot as where you are. So that's all good, too.
Yeah. Well, Deb, as Linda had mentioned previously there just a moment ago, we were just so honored to have you on our MCB board office hours, our 2 o'clock call every Friday afternoon. But thank you again for being our special guest. I think people were really, really impressed. Just the fact that you would take time out of your busy schedule to meet with us. I thank you so much. You did a terrific job in answering questions, listening to us. And I think that's always so important. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. I think it's important to try to hear what people want to know and also to try to hear, you know, what's kind of behind some of that sometimes, because sometimes what we ask isn't actually the heart of what we're trying to get at. And so I think it's really important to try to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Deb, like what we mentioned earlier before we began the recording is we're going to start off talking about your vision loss. So tell our listeners, what was the cause or result of your vision loss?
Well, we actually have no idea. So that takes care of that, I guess. No, seriously, I'll give you a little bit more. So I am of the age group of people who would be part of the RLF or lateral fibroplasia people. I'm in the right group for that. That's the people who got extra oxygen at birth. But I wasn't premature and I didn't get extra oxygen, so they don't have that as an explanation for me. My parents noticed when I was about 3 months old that I wasn't visually tracking correctly, and so they decided to have that checked out. And so it's at that time that they discovered that I was blind. I had better than light perception. I was able to see kind of shapes and outlines of things, could see contrast, could see whether there was print on a page, but I had pretty bad nystagmus, so I couldn't really read print. I was a braille reader from the beginning and a cane traveler from the travel beginnings, but I really did function with some amount of residual vision for a long time. And they always said that I used it really well. The O&M people commented that basically for as little as I had, they thought I used it better than most people who had a lot more. And most people did think I had a lot more vision than I actually really did have. But in the last few years, I developed cataracts, and up to that point, I had had no eye issues per se, no pain, no problems, no anything. So no glaucoma, no bad things. But I began to develop cataracts, and the plan was that they would remove them. That they would remove them in my right eye. They decided they weren't going to remove them in my left eye because over the course of time, I had had a couple of little injuries of life. They weren't really major at the time, but they were resulting in some scarring on my left cornea. So they said that one wasn't worth trying to do, but they would try to do my right eye. And we actually went around to several physicians to get this all sort of worked out. And ultimately, though, when we finally got to the top of the heap of doctors, they decided that I was too great a risk, that because my eyes were a bit small, they decided that they could not get a lens that was exactly the right size. And there had been some experiments done with putting lenses together to try to get this to work, but they were not terribly successful and could result in a retinal detachment, which didn't sound like something I needed. So overall, my physician and I decided that the best course of action was not to perform the surgery or not to try, because it was really, really high risk and could result in some very great misery. So so we didn't do it. So as a result, I am gradually losing the rest of my vision. And I really noticed it with the pandemic, because, you know, during the pandemic, we didn't travel out as much and do as many things that would be unfamiliar or whatever. So then after the pandemic, and maybe about 3 years of really not traveling, it was very, very startling to go out there and see much less than I had seen before. So eventually it will be all gone. And I don't know when that will really be. You know, it is a pretty slow progression. But the big thing that happens now is that a lot of what I see is not accurate. So it might be better when it's gone, because seriously, I get a lot of bad information visually. Yeah. So I never used to. Yeah. I either didn't get it at all, or I got what I got. You know, it would be limited because my field was always limited, but it was at least accurate, but it isn't now. So it's not the useful thing that it used to be. So I have had that experience of having that change, and I think that's a, you know, that's an experience that many of our members and friends go through, and so it's one that I have now experienced.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. I appreciate that. Well, Deb, what I had mentioned to you actually too before we started the recording, want people to really get to know you as a person, get to know Deb Cook Lewis close and up front. So my next question would be, tell us a little bit about your family. Are you married? Do you have kids? Do you have brothers, sisters? So go ahead and share with us.
Sure. So I am married. My husband and I were married in 2007. It's his second marriage, my first. So we're a little older. So we don't have children because we started out past that. And he didn't have any from his first marriage either. So we don't have children. We have one dog, which is my guide dog, Praline. And so we don't have any place for children because I don't think she wants any others. I have two younger sisters. They are both sighted, and people always ask that. Our guys all know that your whole family doesn't have to be blind,
right? Yeah.
But they both do have normal vision. are both retired. My one sister is a retired CPA, and my other sister is a retired dental assistant. They are both married, and one of them has two kids and a bunch of grandkids. I think she has five grandkids, if I remember. Yeah. My other sister does not have kids, and they don't have a dog now either, so I don't know what they have. but they are both married. Their husbands are both retired, so they are. My one sister is big on traveling around. They're gone all the time. My other sister is very big on golfing, and she's gone all the time too, but she's got her golf clubs with her and she's golfing everywhere.
Yeah.
So we don't see very much of them. My father is still living. My father is 91. He is living with my youngest sister. My sisters are 10 years apart from each other in age, and my sister below me is 2 years below, so that makes my youngest sister 12 years younger. But my dad is living with her, and he is 91. My mom passed away about five years ago, right after I retired, really the same week I retired, from pancreatic cancer. So she'd been sick a while. My dad is still living and doing pretty well. And as I said, he's 91. So, you know, I've kind of an average family, not too much unusual to report. My husband is a retired radio broadcaster. And he owns a small internet radio station that he operates and takes care of everything about. And that keeps him very, very busy. But he worked professionally in Bakersfield and in Phoenix. So so that's that. Yeah.
Okay, well, appreciate that. I guess I'm gonna have to reach out to him. You may know Denny Huff. Denny Huff and I do a weekly 90-minute internet radio program called The Gospel Jubilee, which we've been doing since 2014. So may want to talk to your husband at some point in time.
He's been doing this. He did some work on ACB radio back in years ago, but now he's had this since 2008. It's a pretty big concern.
Deb, you mentioned your dog. How long have you had your dog, and what school did you go to get your dog?
Yes, so my dogs have come from Guide Dogs for the Blind. My last dog came from the Boring Oregon campus, so I always refer to her as my boring guide dog. but she's anything but boring. She's she's pretty active. She's 9 years old, going on about two. And maybe three by now. And she's into quite a bit of mischief usually, although right now she's sleeping somewhere. But as soon as she wakes up, she'll be back into mischief again.
Yeah.
She is my sixth dog. I got my first dog in 1972. So I've had them a while. I had a break where I didn't have a dog because of some life circumstances. It just didn't make sense, but most of the time I have, and it's my preferred travel method. But her name is Praline, and she's, like I said, she's nine, so we'll be thinking about retiring her in the next year or two.
And what breed of dog is she?
She is a yellow lab. I've had two black labs and four yellow labs.
Well, I know Linda is just chomping at the bit with some questions, but before I turn it over to her, I got one more question, and that is, share with us a little bit about your education. Where did you go to college?
So I went to public school all the way through school, and and I graduated from school, high school in my hometown, which is a small town in Washington State, Puyallup, Washington. Most people can't pronounce it, but that's what it is. And graduated from high school there. I went to Pacific Lutheran University, which is also in Washington State, and I majored in organ performance. And I minored in voice and theology. And what in the world I was going to do with this, who knew? Because college students never know that sort of thing.
Right.
When I found out that most people with these degrees taught piano students or that sort of thing, I rejected the whole idea. And I dropped out of school and went to work, and later went back and actually got the rest of my degree. But there was a span. So I made it through my junior year, and then I quit for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't needed the degree for anything, it turned out. Back in those days, you really could get away with a lot more in terms of work without a degree, which you wouldn't be able to do now.
Sure.
But yeah. They just use it now to weed everybody out. But basically back then you could get by if you had some experience that they could use, or they were desperate or whatever. And so so I was doing fine, but I decided that it would look better. It was too hard to always explain why I didn't have the degree.
Yeah.
So, you know, why don't you have it? Well, I quit. So so you know, that's how that goes. But I did finally get it. But yeah, I never did actually. I did a lot of work related to it that I got paid for. I did a lot of work in churches, and I played thousands and thousands of weddings and funerals and whateverings, and made all kinds of money in college and after. But I never actually had full-time employment.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering how accommodating that you found college to be. Were they pretty accommodating? Because from what you just said, they seem to be pretty understandable.
Well, you know, there were some really interesting challenges. First of all, I was in a kind of a challenging situation prior to college. So I was used to not being accommodated. I was the only blind student in the school district where I went to school. And to be honest with you, we rarely had my books in an accessible format. You know, my mom read a lot of stuff to me. I had teachers read a lot of stuff, you know, record and read a lot of stuff for me. There wasn't much in Braille, you know, and so I was used to it being tough going. And so in a way for me, going to college was almost easier, because now a lot of my books were available from what was then called RFB, Recordings for the Blind.
Yeah,
They've had a couple of name changes, but you know, they had a lot of my books by the time I got to college. What was really tough, and what really did ultimately stop me, was that being a music major was incredibly tough, and still, it wouldn't be impossible, but would still be tough at the college level, because, you know, there were Braille scores for many of the masterworks that you would want to play, but you know, you're still having to memorize them, which other people don't have to do. And if you had any question about what was in Braille music, there wasn't anybody to ask. And so you just had to try to compare it with a score. And then when you took composition classes, you had to dictate your composition. Now that would be easier now, because you can electronically play things and have them digitized.
Right.
And so
you
can do that differently now. And so there's some really neat stuff available, that none of which was available at all when I was in school. So that would be easier, but it would still be a very, very difficult program to take. And I just found it pretty darn exhausting. Mm-hmm. So But as far as regular coursework was concerned, I think I had it easier in college than I had it in high school. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks for sharing that with us. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering, where's Bev Cascaden? Believe it or not, she chose to go off and have some fun at camp this weekend and is not available. I can't believe it, Linda. She actually decided to go off and have fun at camp rather than participate in today's interview with
I'm
our
with
special
her.
Guest.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm with her. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can't believe it either. She chose to go for a weekend instead of doing something her president asked her to do.
Really? Yeah. Well, Linda, I know you've got some really great questions for our guest today, so I'm just going to pass it over to you.
Thank you. Yes, Deb, you have been blind since birth. Mm-hmm. When did you join into the Washington State affiliate, or when were you introduced to a group of people?
Yeah. Okay. So those would be actually two different answers, really, because my parents were involved in the National Federation of the Blind of Washington. My parents were sighted, but my dad was particularly interested in legislative kinds of things. And so from a very early age, my dad was part of NFB. And we didn't have an ACB chapter in the part of the state where I lived. We did have an ACB affiliate when ACB came to being. But we didn't have a chapter where we were. My parents, like I said, my dad in particular was part of NFB. So I was familiar with that stuff and familiar with legislative things a little bit. And a lot of my dad's role was, he believed that it was important that blind people represent themselves and represent their issues. But he recognized that you might need a drive to the state capitol. And so he, which was 40 miles away. So, and there wasn't transit to it. So, you know, he provided that. So he drove people and went with them to the offices and that sort of thing, but usually waited outside when they went in to talk to legislators or do whatever it was, you know. So he was really providing that support, but he was a member. And so the natural thing was for me to become a member of NFB as well. And again, most, you know, as much, yeah, my dad was, but the other part of that was that that's what we had. So I believe very strongly, I still believe very strongly, even as president of ACB, that it is good to be part of an organization of the blind. And I, of course, want you to belong to ours. But if ours is not available to you readily and the other one is and it's welcoming and you don't feel conflicted by it in some way, then I think you should join. So I do feel that way. And so anyway, I did. So I was part of NFB until I moved away from the Seattle area. And that would be in about 1980. No, it might have even been a little bit longer. Probably a little bit longer. So so somewhere in the mid 80s, I kind of dropped out of all of it. I was working for the state, and the state at that point, it had been a kind of an NFB agency, but then it was not anymore. And they kind of were disparaging of their staff really being too active in any organization. They kind of wanted people to be neutral. And so the best way to stay neutral was just not to be active at all. So I wasn't. But then when I went to work at the university, I could do that again. At this time, I actually joined our Washington Council of the Blind, which is the ACB affiliate. And there were several reasons for that. Our state affiliate had been kicked out of the NFB and was NFB reformed itself in our state. And so most of my friends, maybe all of my friends at that point, were part of ACB suddenly, because that's what had happened. So it sort of made sense that I was kind of coming back to the same organization. It was just under a different umbrella. So I came back in, I think it was 93, and stayed in ACB ever since that time, and held several state offices. Well, to be more specific, I held the office of treasurer several times. And so that was kind of my claim to fame, and was involved with that, resolutions chair, various other things at the state level, organized a chapter or two, did a variety of things at the state level. So that was kind of how I became involved, kind of across back and forth. In my state, I still have very, very good relationship with both organizations. Of course, I'm still a member of the ACB affiliate, but I also still have a very, very good relationship with our NFB affiliate. And so have worked collaboratively with them over the years, but have chosen to stay a member of ACB.
That sounds great. So mm-hmm. when you stepped to national level, what was your first office or committee that you worked on?
Well, actually, in the mid-90s, during Paul Edwards at National Administration, I was chair of the Information Access Committee. But then I didn't do anything again nationally until 2016, when I was elected to the Board of Publications and began to serve there.
Sounds interesting. I just got my Braille form today and was have been reading it, and the currency was very much one of the articles I enjoyed, and I'm anxious to see the new $10 bill.
Yeah. We're all looking forward to that. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, absolutely. Yeah.
That all sounds good. When you left college and you went to work, where did you actually go to work? And
So I first went to work when I left college. I really didn't know what I was going to do, because I didn't have a degree, and I also didn't have any real work experience. I had the music experience, but I really didn't have, I already knew that I wasn't going to make a good living doing that. So unless I could get really famous, and it was hardly likely. So I was really baffled about this, and I decided to do something that really paid off. So I decided to become a professional volunteer while I looked for work. So I went down to, we had something that was part of our United Way. It was called the Volunteer Bureau. And, you know, cities have something like this. It's different places. But this was what we had. And so I went to the Volunteer Bureau and I said, I would like to volunteer. I'm available 4 days a week. I have to have a day to look for work. And sleep in and do whatever, but I am available 4 days a week. I would like to have not all my 4 days spent at one location. I'd like different jobs, and I would like real jobs, because, you know, sometimes we have volunteers come and do nothing, and sometimes we have volunteers come and do really cool things. I'd like the cool assignments, please. And what I would also like is to have them with people who, if I do a good job, would give me a letter of reference. So we kind of thought about that. And of course, this was 1974. So we want to kind of get the time frame in here. What kind of accommodations there are out there? We had no computers, no nothing. You know, I had my little typewriter and whatever. So it had to be things that we could make accessible, and that we could make accessible easily and cheaply. But I had a wonderful person who was the volunteer, you know, coordinator and assignment person, and she gave me these, you know, great places to pick from and jobs to do, and I took my little jobs and I went in for my little interviews, and I was so fortunate because they all wanted me. They did have real jobs. they did need real people with real skills who could reliably show up and do the work for free. And they were very receptive to my request, which was that if I do a good job, I mean, if I don't do a great job, you know, please don't do this for me. But if I do a great job, I want a letter of reference. And that letter needs to say that if we actually had money and could hire you, we would. And they all said, yeah, that's a fair deal. If you work out that way, we will. So I began looking for work and doing my volunteer jobs, and I did them and looked for work and did them and looked for work. And pretty soon I found a job I'd like to apply for. I found a few, actually. And I began to apply for them, and I asked for my letters, and oh, they gave me such nice letters. And they weren't letters about how, oh, she did great for a blind person or whatever. They were just good letters. They didn't say anything about my being blind. None of them did, actually. They just talked about the fact that I came, I was on time, I was always appropriate, I handled the public really well, I could deal with stuff that was confidential, I could solve problems, I could whatever it was they thought I could do for them, and whatever I had done, and yes, that if they had an opening, and when they had an opening, they would definitely consider me for it. So you better take her first, because eventually we will have an opening, we'll give it to her. So I had all these letters, I had four of them. And wow. I took them everywhere I went. And I said, you know, I don't really have much work experience. I didn't finish college. I have all this music experience. So if you need somebody to play music on breaks, I'm really good at that. And I have these great letters. Would you like to hire me? And I had no trouble getting a job. So I went to work, actually, for a nonprofit that was providing what would be now the Older Blind Program, but it wasn't then. And so I went to work for them initially, and working in their office. And then later I went to work for the city, doing employment, finding people jobs, getting employment for people on the CETA program, which was the Comprehensive Employment Training Act. It had a number of iterations after that. One of my coworkers called those the sons of CETA. But anyway, I worked on that project for a long time. And then eventually, I had another short period of unemployment. So I reenacted my little thing about how you volunteer and get some letters. Plus, I now had experience. Did that, and then I went to work for the state in 1980 and worked the rest of my career till 2018, which was about 38 years with the state of Washington.
That's great. And then jumping forward, mm-hmm. Dan Spoon got moved up and mm-hmm. you stepped up.
Yeah.
And what has been the experience of stepping from vice president?
Holy mackerel. Yeah. So there are two pivotal moments in my career with ACB. I think I have talked about them both, because they're pretty funny and they're pretty parallel. So the first one was actually right after I was elected to first vice president, and I had been elected to first vice president a couple of weeks, and I got a call. It was a Thursday evening. I'll never forget it. Got a call from Dan Spoon in the evening, a little later than Dan usually calls. You know, he's 3 hours ahead of me in time, so he can call late, but he didn't usually call that late. So it was fine for me, but a little odd for him. So I remembered as I was answering the phone, I was like, what does Dan want? Well, what Dan wanted was to tell me that he was about to go to the hospital for emergency heart bypass surgery. And he was going to be in the hospital, and they were very optimistic, but oh, by the way, he wouldn't be available for the infamous meeting that ACB had, where we took the vote about whether all members would be able to vote or not. And so he was like, and you'll have to chair that because I won't be there. And, you know, he was so disappointed because, of course, he'd been really working for this so hard. And now it was about to happen, we thought, and it did. But it was about to happen and he wouldn't be there. And I was like, gulp, you know. So we got through that. Everybody was so helpful and supportive, and I did this, and it was what it was, and it was the truly momentous occasion that we wanted it to be, where the members voted that every member, whether they attended the convention or not, could vote. And that has changed the face of so many things with ACB and will change some more things in the future. But in the meantime, so when we got up now to Eric's resignation, Dan and I had been actually talking for a while about the fact that it was a matter of time before Eric would get a new job. And we didn't know which side of Dan's presidency it would land on. We just knew that he was looking, and we knew that it was inevitable. And so that was about all we could do. Eric had not shared any additional with us, so that's all we could do. But we did talk about it occasionally. So the day he called, he's like, I've got news. And I said, the last time you called me with news, you were having bypass surgery. What is it now? So he said, well, the other shoe has dropped. Eric has accepted a job with ACB. And I said, oh, I said, well, I think that means we need to hire you and promote me. And he goes, well, that's what Eric said we should do, but he said, I didn't know what you'd think of it. And I said, oh, I think it's the only option we have. So Dan was wonderful to work with, is wonderful to work with, but he was wonderful to work with in the transition, because one of the things that he and I agreed to was that the show must go on. We were 3 months from a convention, and we had a number of other balls in the air, and we could not change our roles. So basically, although Dan became the executive director, he continued to do a great deal of the coordination that he would normally do. And I have had traditionally for the last several years since the pandemic, a significant role in planning and implementing the convention. And it could not happen without my continuing to do that. So we kept our roles and overlapped and did our thing until July. And so in July, then we really made the switches. And it's been interesting for me personally, because I work very differently than Dan. I have a very different style than Dan does. I totally admire him. I totally respect him. I totally support him, but I work differently. And so when you inherit someone else's job and you inherit it kind of suddenly, you inherit a lot of expectations from people about how that's going to be delivered. And so it has been a bit of a challenge for me to figure out how to modify my style and modify this job so that they come together in a better way. And so that has been a very big for me. And you know, it's not so much more hours in the day. I think I put in about 60 hours a week for ACB, frankly. And I think I've done that for a while. And I think that it's what I accept. But the hours are spent differently than they used to be. And I think that for me has been the biggest challenge. So it has been a real culture shock. And occasionally I say, I want my old job back. But I need to not do that, because that doesn't help people, you know, develop confidence in you. But I'm not sure. I do kind of think some days I want my old job back.
I think you're doing an excellent job.
Yes, so. Yes.
Kip, if you would like to ask a couple of more questions.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Thank you so much. Deb, you mentioned about during your early years, your connection with the NFB of Washington State. Here in Missouri, we work very well with our NFB of Missouri membership. I've got to know, and in fact, she's been one of my closest friends since she and I met back in the, around 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's the president of the mm-hmm. NFB of Missouri, and we mm-hmm. still work very closely together. Started mm-hmm. an organization called Technology Association for mm-hmm. Visually Impaired Missourians. Mm-hmm. And she is still a member of NFB, of course, been the mm-hmm. state president. Sure. And so mm-hmm. we work very closely, but we also work closely on some legislative issues within uh-huh. our state, uh-huh. specifically regarding surrounding voting accessibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then the former president of NFB of Missouri, he and I mm-hmm. too work very closely together. We are worked closely together on a state organization. So, you know, just having those connections mm-hmm. like that,
yeah.
I really, really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I can certainly agree with what you were mm-hmm. sharing with us earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I want to hear, we don't have a whole lot of time left here, but mm-hmm. I know that ACB offers a great deal of services and programs. But what I would like for you to share with us, what services and programs that you can really identify with or that stands out in your mind that you have benefited from personally that you wouldn't mind sharing with us? Is there one or two of the services and programs that ACB offers or provides that really stick out in your mind that you have benefited from?
Oh, well, you know, ACB Media is very close to my heart, and partly because I have done, you know, broadcast work there and things and helped with conventions there and things, but also in another way, one of the things that has been very, very important to me and why I jumped up during the pandemic to say we can help affiliates continue to have conventions if they want to and have them virtually. When I mentioned earlier that there was a period of time when I wasn't active in national or state things much for ACB, and I was a member, and that was for at least some of those years was because I was caring for my housemate. This is before I was married. And actually at the beginning of my marriage, but I was caring for my housemate who was terminally ill. And I couldn't travel because I had 24/7 care giving with her most of the time with very few breaks. Anyway, one of the things that was so valuable to me personally was the connection to ACB and to the community through ACB Media. And we didn't have Zoom, but you could listen to the national convention, a lot of it on delay, but you could listen to some of it live, but you could listen. And you could listen to our state affiliate took advantage of ACB Media as early as 2006. To stream our conventions, and so a few others did as well. And so the fact that was available to me during this period when I was really isolated because of the circumstance that I had, that meant so much to me that I have really committed a lot of my energy and time to making sure that level of connection is available to other people, because I know that whether it's the pandemic or whether it's people's personal circumstances or their health or their age or their whatever, we don't want our members to be cut off from the organization just because they can't be with us in person anymore or right now. So that to me was so meaningful, to have people spending their time making this available to me, that I just committed that would be a personal priority of mine. So that's perhaps the one that, you know, has been most impactful to me. And then I think, you know, just in general, the work that ACB does and is doing around all of the different advocacy issues, our work with the accessible testing during the pandemic, which is extending out now to other testing. So if people are having, you know, other illnesses or pregnancy testing or other kinds of testing that are currently not accessible, that technology that was used for the pandemic is becoming available to those other products as well. And I think that is extremely important and meaningful, and was to me personally. So, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that. Deb, I have two quick questions in just the short time that we have remaining. What is there about Deb Cook Lewis? What makes her click? What makes her tick that, you know, share with us something that really nobody knows about Deb Cook Lewis, except maybe like your husband or those that are really close to you, that you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners?
Oh, you know, I think something that people just absolutely don't believe about me, but is incredibly painfully true. I am an absolute introvert. And people don't think so. And one of the things I did allude to that when I mentioned, well, Dan and I are very different. Dan is very extroverted. Dan is energized by people. I am energized by work. And it's a good thing because there's plenty of work out here, but I struggle with all the people things. And I struggle with all of the, you know, the all of the sort of going around and they told me for the national convention, you have to go to all these things and meet these kind of people in the, okay. So for me, and people think that because I look comfortable and I try to act comfortable, but I am so miserably introverted, and I can hardly wait to get back to my room. It's like, and I certainly don't, I try really hard not to look that part and not to be that part and to be genuine about it, not to be forced. I mean, I think it's, if you're not genuine, you know, people won't believe you.
Yeah. Sure.
But it if you want to talk about something that is foreign to me and hard for me, I am much better with a project than I am a room full of people.
Okay, well, thank you again for sharing that with us. All right, so last question. What words of encouragement would you like to offer, say, for individuals that may be newly blind, or even individuals that's been blind for quite some time but have never been able to come to grips with their blindness, never been able to accept their blindness? What words of encouragement would you be able to offer?
Well, you know, I think one of the most valuable things to do is to have some kind of, whatever you're dealing with in your life and whatever you're challenged by in your life, I think that peer support is one of the most significant things. And I think it's one of the things that our affiliates all do well and can do well. And I just want to give a pitch out for our ACB community with respect to that, because we have so many fabulous calls that deal with every aspect of adjustment to anything, adjustment to vision loss, adjustment to terminal illness, adjustment to aging, adjustment to needing more exercise, adjustment to whatever it is that we're thinking about and struggling with in our lives. And our community has just offered such a non-judgmental place of support for people. And I have seen people really come out of themselves and participate. And all you have to do that is get to a telephone or to a computer and join in. And so I can't, you know, I was really kind of down on this when they started. I was like, are you kidding? But then you remember, I'm an introvert. So of course I would be, but actually I've really seen the value of it. And I just, and the same things that our affiliates and our chapters are doing, get with some people, share how you're feeling. You'll find that there's somebody who's experienced what you have, or can empathize with it, or can be providing some helpful resources. And there's nothing like peer support.
I'm glad that you said that. I tell you, during those real early years when I was really mm-hmm. struggling with my mm-hmm. vision loss, I didn't want to be blind. I didn't mm-hmm. ask to be blind. I mm-hmm. hated being blind. Mm-hmm. And I went through a number of years of downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't for the fact that I finally got involved with the blindness community, it brought mm-hmm. me out of all of that. I don't know right. where I'd be today if I hadn't joined back mm-hmm. there then a local mm-hmm. affiliate within the state of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
It meant so much to me. And over the years, it mm-hmm. has afforded me so many wonderful opportunities that mm-hmm. I would have never been able to experience
right.
had I not joined together with right. this, with our state affiliate. So,
well, again, and now that we have so much technology available, it isn't required geographically that you be next to people. I mean, there's no affiliate here. Neither organization has an affiliate where I live. And yet I can still be very, very connected to whatever people I choose for whatever commonality I choose. And I think that's just amazing.
Yes. Yep. I certainly do agree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Deb, thank you so very much for being our special mm-hmm. guest here today on Meet the People of MCB. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, thank you both. It's been great.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you know somebody that you would like for Bev and I to interview next time here on Meet the People of MCB, and by the way, thank you, Linda, for stepping in and taking Deb's place. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you know somebody that you would like for Beverly and I to interview next time here on Meet the People of MCB, you can have them give me a call, Chip Haley, at 417-540-9703. You never know. You might hear yourself right back here next time on Meet the People of MCB. Until then, catch y'all right back here, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy your week, everybody. Bye-bye for now.